For our May-June issue, we have a special treat for our listeners, a double feature. First up is A Place for Pax, read and written by Colin Mattson, followed by Collateral Damage by Jen Downs. Both stories feature spunky protagonists who are making do in futures that feature farming, ingenuity, and creative solutions. Enjoy.
Rain battered the window above Pax's desk. It had been raining all day, but the wind seemed to have shifted and now it was coming in sideways. It was loud. She liked it. The more she heard of the rain, the less she could make out of the incongruous choir of voices that typically echoed through the house. Danny's staccato yelps as matches went his way or didn't. The calm, faux-pleasant monotone of Mom's customer negotiation voice. The rain assailed her windowpane and drowned them out with a percussive static that was at once comforting and loud as hell. It was the background she needed to refocus and soldier through her final assignment for PC 407, Physical Computation, Dynamic Load Analysis. Her choice of a double major in structural engineering and restorative permaculture had been a surprise to her counselors, but they had known better than to try and dissuade her. The engineering department didn't share much of the student population with AA, agriculture and aquaculture, but Pax had started helping in the family aqua plot as a toddler, and by her early teens she had her very own plot share allotment. She was always going to be a farmer. Hopefully she could be an engineer too. She was thinking through the last question of the assignment when her stomach rumbled and broke her concentration. As Pax shifted her consciousness out of her workspace and back into the physical world, her room, she realized just how hungry she was. She couldn't blame the interface. There had been all kinds of complications with the wrong sensory input getting blocked at the wrong time when immersion interfaces had first been introduced, but that was over a century ago. She knew that when she got into a project for school, she got way into it, and sometimes that meant forgetting lunch. She got up and headed into the great space to find something to eat. Danny had been out on the plot this morning and picked a fresh bushel of wakampos that were now sitting in a colander in the sink to drain. Aside from that, there was some pod milk that Mom had strained last night and a fresh loaf of bread that she must have baked on a break between calls earlier in the day. Pax layered cold wakampo slices and a chunk of goat's cheese she'd traded for yesterday between two thick hunks of steaming hot bread and sauntered off to the patio to eat. Damien and Leela had a much bigger plot of land than Pax's family. They had traded most of their aqua plot for it, and now instead of farming the sea, they raised goats. One of the perks of farming was fresh local barter, and Leela's goat cheese was a hot commodity. Pax had traded 4 big bushels of wakampos for a chunk about twice the size of her fist, and biting into the sandwich now, she couldn't help but think that was a bargain. The richness and acidity of the cheese paired with the subtly sweet, briny wakampo was something she could eat every day and never get tired of. Through the rain, Pax could see the speckled gray metallic sheen of the roof of the biggest of Damien and Leela's 3 sheds. She thought of the rain on her window and on the roof of the patio now, and how ridiculously loud it must be in that uninsulated goat shed. She loved watching the rain, and holy Gaia, she loved goat cheese. Ritter, Carolina wasn't a big town. Being that it was on the coast, there was a spattering of typical sea farmer types, and a few folks who raised livestock mixed in with the usual crowd of net workers like Mom and Danny. Pax knew everyone and everything in Ritter. She had also known for some time now that she had some decisions to make. She had stretched out her final semesters of university as much as she plausibly could, but at long last, a little over a week from now, she was going to graduate. Her colleagues had been buzzing for almost all of the previous year about their plans after graduation, some chasing jobs on prestigious projects, some traveling to big cities or exotic backwaters, some moving off planet. She loved hearing about their plans and was genuinely excited for them, but none of that felt right for her. She was glad to be graduating, but what was she going to do? What did she actually want to do? She polished off the final corner of her sandwich and headed back inside. In the distance, she could hear goats bleating at her back. That night the rain subsided, and her room was filled with frog song, punctuated by the occasional sandpiper. After submitting her assignment, an analysis of the stability of a popular open-source agricultural shed design under dynamic wind-loading forces, she had been struck by how normal it felt. Her final day of university wasn't a big party or a crazy up-all-night marathon project. It was just another day at home. Some people might be disappointed by that, but she found that she liked it. This was her. Here. And that's when she started deciding, what if she stayed in Ritter? She needed to get out of her mom's house, but that didn't mean she had to leave town. Money would be a problem, but that would be the case no matter where she lived, and plenty of other places were far more expensive. The only assets to her name, aside from some meager savings, were her inbound degree and a small chunk of the family aqua plot at the far end. Her mind wandered back to the project and the shed. Her professor had picked the design because it was easily accessible and free. Being an agricultural shed, it was also simple and straightforward to construct. 15 meters long and just over 7 wide, the rectangular footprint was more than enough for her to live in. The design didn't include climate control, water treatment, or interior walls, but those were easy enough to add. She could build that shed, and she could make it home. But where could she put it? The goats were louder than usual. Cassie the chicken was squawking. She had a headache, and the water for her coffee wasn't ready yet. Someone was knocking at the door, and Damien was still asleep. Fucking Gaia. Leela kicked her slippers on and shuffled to the front door with a weary sense of wrath that was both unreasonable and exactly what some asshole knocking at her door at 6:30 in the morning should expect. Good morning. Was wondering if you all would like some breakfast. Leela's rage immediately subsided. Pax Morrison was her favorite neighbor by about a kilometer, and one of the best things Ritter as a whole had going for it. When she left town to go train asteroid robots or breed seaweed clones on Titan or whatever the hell else genius kids did after university, it was going to be a sad day for this town. She should have seen it coming a kilometer away. A batch of fresh muffins first thing in the morning? When was the last time anyone brought her baked goods at sunrise without an ulterior motive? Damien had brought her croissants for breakfast a few times back when they started dating, but he always had an angle. So never. The last time was never, and this was no exception. She had to admit that it was a solid strategy. Ply her with steaming hot muffins and youthful exuberance before casually sliding the offer into their conversation. Free labor for 3 years on their as-yet-unused aqua plot, in exchange for a tiny corner of land out past the edge of the pasture. The labor was limited to regular plantings, harvests, and maintenance, and their plot was small. But the land in question was also small, currently unused, and of questionable value to begin with. Pax was an accomplished farmer. It seemed reasonable that they could get more value out of 3 years of her occasional labor than they could by selling the 0.05 hectare parcel, and that's if they could find anyone who wanted to buy it. Besides, maybe this way they could keep Pax around town for a few more years. They might even get some muffins out of it from time to time. Things were coming together nicely. Pax had struck a deal for a small parcel of land at the corner of Damien and Leela's plot. She had started modifying the shed design, and she figured she was another solid day-ish away from a workable set of plans. She was working from the outside in, starting by substituting the original stick-framed sheet metal exterior for one built of Nitrobond bricks. Nitrobond was a stupid name. The molecule, a carbon-nitrogen lattice, and the process for creating it literally out of thin air with nothing but electricity, had been developed and aggressively patented by a company named Nitrobond in the 2040s. The name had stuck around long after they disappeared. At the time, the preceding boom in electricity generation had outpaced the development of energy storage, and the overwhelming majority of new power generation was from renewable sources that engineers like to call bursty, as in the energy came in bursts when it was particularly windy or sunny, and less so at other times. Bursty power sources required storage to smooth over the differences between supply and demand in real time. If your system is short on energy storage, you can also solve the problem by generating more power than you need all the time and then wasting a variable amount. Conveniently, around this same time, the carbon capture market was getting hot. Nitrobon powered the grid-attached, on-surplus manufacturing of the building materials that became most of the infrastructure in North America in the late 21st century. It was a simple business model. When a utility decided there was too much energy in the grid, they signaled a Nitrobon plant to kick on. It sucked up a known and controllable amount of power and made Nitrobon powder, bricks, sheets, or other products, and stockpiled them locally. When the utility needed more power for the grid, they signaled the plant to shut down. Depending on the details of the agreement for that plant, the utility, Nitrobon, or both would then sell the building materials and bill the local authority for sucking a chunk of CO2 out of the atmosphere. As carbon cap prices receded in the early 2100s and energy storage became ever cheaper and more plentiful, Nitrobon plants became less common. But Ritter still had one, just up Route 303 outside town. Best of all, it had been repossessed by the town a few decades ago when the previous owner walked away from their tax bill, and so an effectively unlimited supply of bricks were free for the taking, so long as you could actually come and take them. Pax would need to figure out material transport soon, but first she had to finish the design. She was focusing on the major structural and exterior elements first so that she could get a shell built before worrying about fitting out the interior. She thought she could probably salvage or trade for a lot of the material she would need, but she was going to have to pay for at least two major components, power and water treatment. She was quickly approaching the point where she needed to know the details of those systems in order to finish the design, and so she decided it was time for a visit to Abera's. Eric Abera had never planned on being a scrapper. He loved chemistry and had thought seriously about teaching it. But when his father decided to take a job on one of the new Jovian Lagrange stations, he gave Eric a choice of gifts: the deed to the family salvage business, or a free ride along with him to a space station quite literally in the middle of nowhere. Eric had less interest in space travel than he did in scrapping, and so here he was. Abera's warehouse was not the sort of slick, clean, hyper-efficient, fully automated logistics mecca that most people conjured when thinking of the word warehouse. Instead, it was more of a historical interpretation, a big building full of stuff, a house of wares, if you will. Eric's great-grandparents had acquired the facility and the grounds with the intent of starting an aircraft hydrogen retrofit business that never really panned out. Instead, they ended up using the main hangar as storage for parts and salvage catering to the businesses that they had originally intended to compete against. Over the years, the focus of the inventory and the customers who were interested in it had gradually broadened, and now you could find just about anything at Abera's. The only thing Eric was surprised to find in the warehouse today was Pax Morrison. She had messaged last night asking about batteries and water recyclers, but people did that all the time. Eric hadn't seen Inbox Zero in years. What she did next was the surprising thing. Rather than ordering a delivery, she actually showed up in person. "It's not that I don't trust you. I just really want to see them for myself first." "Sure. Batteries are in D-17 with the other ground vehicle parts. Water treatment you're interested in is with Astro in T-25. I don't have much here that's capable of testing either of them, so remember, everything is sold as is." "Not a problem. I brought my tools." Eric wouldn't let the average customer tear into the internals of high-voltage battery packs or spacecraft systems, but he knew Pax was more than capable of not letting the magic smoke out. She had tutored him in bioscience and physics and was probably at least partially responsible for his early infatuation with chemistry. He might have maybe been infatuated with her too, but that was a long time ago. He was in the office thinking back on Pax the tutor when a message from Pax the customer broke his reverie. She would take both items. Eric noted the aisle and bay designations and added tasks for delivery pre-processing to tonight's queue. He was just about to start his daily inbox grind when he thought better of it, disconnected, and headed out to the warehouse floor. It wasn't often that he got visitors in person, even less so those he wanted to talk to. He might as well make the most of it. She was going to have to cut a skylight in the roof. Fuck. Skylights were nice things, quite desirable when one had money to buy extra windows and labor to cut holes in the roof. Quite undesirable when one was broke and attempting their first self-build, but it was the only way she could think of to get her soon-to-be new-to-her water treatment system working and keep it in that state without a constant influx of custom biologicals. The system was ancient, manufactured in the opening weeks of 2102 in Kent, Washington, It was designed as the primary water recycler for a spacefaring vehicle crewing 15 to 20 humans. As with most astro equipment of the era, it had been gloriously overbuilt, able to process 280 liters of water every 24 hours in perpetuity. The kicker was, it required a custom-engineered cocktail of algae and bacteria fed in every few days, and specialized membrane cartridges replaced every few weeks in order to function at that level. Which was probably why she was able to buy it in the first place. Modern recyclers could use a wide variety of biological inputs, didn't need them nearly as often, and typically didn't require membrane changes more often than every year or two. Hence, they were much more desirable and expensive. This unit was going to be tricky to work with, but she didn't need it to operate anywhere near full capacity. When Pax found the unit in the inventory manifest at Abera's and saw the price tag, she had started digging around on the net. Others had adapted these same units for terrestrial service with decent enough results. She had been gaming out the cost of buying the engineered biomix when she came across an interesting post. Apparently, the engineered bio really preferred low G. Using it in a clean, rebuilt unit with a new membrane at surface gravity, the poster reported getting around 200 liters a day at first, but within a day or so that had dropped to just over 100, and within another few days it wasn't able to process much at all. After a full clean-out in another new membrane, they had tried a common terrestrial recycler algae mix. This time the bio stayed happy, but the output was a trickle. Third try, they swapped out the proprietary membrane for a common one used in terrestrial recyclers, and with that and a new load of terrestrial algae, they were able to sustain around 85 liters a day for several weeks before needing to top up the bio. This is what had convinced her to take the plunge. If she could get anything close to 85 liters a day out of this unit with conventional bio, it could run all the plumbing in her house indefinitely. At the reduced rate she'd be running it at, membranes would probably last months, and as long as she could use common terrestrial variants, she could buy or barter for them easily. She would need ready access to algae, though, and that's where the skylight came in. She could buy algae every few weeks if necessary, but she was going to be short on money, especially at first after dumping her life savings into the build. Some posters on the net had built a setup with a bioreactor that could generate the necessary algae for the recycler using some of the unprocessed wastewater and a small amount of clean water, combined with plenty of sunlight. She had considered building a little breeder box outside the house, but after reading more, it sounded like climate control would be critical. Since the algae liked roughly the same temperature range she did, it would be easier to build the breeder box into the house itself, and so she would be shopping for skylight glass. The skylight would slightly reduce the PV surface area and proportionally her power generation, but she had plenty of margin there. She also needed tanks. Not including the breeder box setup, her recycler would need 4 tanks. Fresh water, recycler output. Gray water, recycler input from drains. Black water, recycler input from the toilet. And top-up, unfiltered rainwater. In a fixed setting, when you weren't worried about moving the mass of the filled tanks around, it was usually to your advantage to oversize them to accommodate for variance in usage, rainfall and reclamation rates, as well as potential downtime when the recycler required maintenance or cleaning. She was shooting for 200 liter capacity for fresh and gray water. She could probably get away with 100 liters for black water, and her top-up tank would end up being whatever she could find that was fairly large and tough enough to be mounted outside and plumbed into the main roof gutter. It never really hit freezing in Ritter, and it rained pretty regularly throughout the year. From a climate perspective, she had water treatment on easy mode, and she was fine with that. Pax was in the middle of filling out her third set of forms for the property registration on her new home site when her mom tapped her on the shoulder. She insisted on doing this, physically interrupting her immersion session rather than messaging. It was another reason Pax had to get out of the house. On Mom's day off, she couldn't get anything done. "Hey, were you planning on working the plot today?" "I was in the middle of something." "Oh, I know. I just like talking to you in person."
"You could always message me and I could finish what I was doing and then we could talk in person."
"I know, but you're right there and I just couldn't help it."
"No, I wasn't planning on working the plot."
"Well, Danny was out there earlier and he said it looks like we need to harvest soon or we're going to start losing pods." A wave of guilt washed over her. Between finishing up coursework and working on her house design, Pax hadn't been out to the plot in days. Wacampo could be a fickle crop. Ripe pods had to be picked immediately or they would start taking on too much water and disintegrate. She had a lot of admiration for the team of students that engineered them some 90 years ago, but days like today she wished they would have tuned this particular aspect a little more. The students had been trying to grow a sweet potato hybrid that could tolerate salt water by editing in genes from wakame seaweed. They had a grant from a large ag company, and as the term neared its end, the firm determined their work to be a failure. What they had been able to grow resembled a squishy, peeled russet potato wrapped in slimy, green, elongated cabbage leaves. The company brass were so off-put by the crop's appearance and the fact that it would never be marketable as a sweet potato that they neglected to investigate its other merits. The fruits were impressively nutrient-dense, could be eaten raw, that's how Pax liked them, and were shelf-stable at room temperature for days, in refrigeration for weeks. The plant grew quickly in a wide range of seafloor conditions across a reasonably wide temperature range and had no natural pests. Mature plants would sprout new pods continuously as long as the water temperature was high enough, and so in many places, the aquaplots produced year-round. When the ag company walked away from the project, the ownership rights reverted to the students, who had not overlooked the merits of their work. They published all of their research, including the full genetics of the plant, as the first open-source engineered crop, which is why farmers like Pax could afford to grow it. Let me finish these forms up, and I'll head out. The family plot was a square, 150 meters on a side, starting at the shoreline. The first 20 meters from shore weren't deep enough for Wacampo, so they grew a shallow variant of trikelp for filtration and carbon sink credits. Pax rowed out into the deeper section and moored the boat to their floating dock. Wacampos tended to sprout pods on the upper third of the plant, so assuming you had mature plants, the deeper the water, the more pods. Pax strapped on her knife and bag net, donned her mask, and dived in. The goats were inconsolable. Not that there was any danger or really any meaningful change in their lives at all, as far as Leela could see. But still, the bleeding would not stop. Pax's material had started showing up in her plot 2 days ago, and apparently the temporary presence of delivery drones was simply too much for them. They bleated and screamed and jumped up and down on their ramps and hay bales so vigorously she was worried they were going to break something. Whether that would be ramp boards, bale twine, or goat bones, Leela wasn't sure. When the first of the drones, an aerial, had dropped out of the sky to deposit some smallish package, two of the kids had actually fainted. Fucking Gaia, how did these things ever survive pre-domestication? She had read that the fainting was apparently considered a defense mechanism, and she had some serious questions for the author of that work. Nevertheless, the goats were unharmed and very, very agitated. Since that first delivery, there had been a steady cadence of arrivals, small stuff by air, big stuff by land. She had been out with the goats yesterday when two whole pallets of what appeared to be Pax's new roof showed up. All of it was just sitting out there now, some tarped, most wide open to the elements. One of the things Leela loved about Ritter was that Pax didn't think to secure any of this stuff. That pile of solar tiles, windows, and printer excreta very likely represented Pax's life savings, but she had no qualms about leaving it in a field next to some whiny goats. The sun was coming up over the hill to the east, and there was a light breeze coming with it. Leela was on the porch enjoying her coffee and contemplating breakfast when she glimpsed a figure trudging up the drive pulling what looked like a farm cart. A few minutes later she could resolve Pax Morrison towing a cart that appeared to contain a baking dish with a plaid towel draped over the top and what looked an awful lot like a construction brick. "Good morning. Was wondering if you all would like some breakfast. I'll take some of those muffins off your hands, but I don't usually eat Nitrobon this early in the day." "Yeah, so I was hoping to use your laser mill." "I knew it. Unsolicited baked goods this early in the morning always come at a price." Leela was about to tell Pax that Damien wasn't up yet and that she didn't know how to work the mill. Then she remembered that Pax had set it up for them in the first place. "Sure. It'll cost you 4 muffins. What are you milling?" "Well, I'm starting the foundation today. This will be the first brick, and I thought I might engrave it." "Have at it." The mill was in the closest of their sheds, the only one not filled with goats. Leela helped Pax get the brick up onto the mill platform, and Pax got to work reconfiguring the controls. Damien had been using it to burn their farm logo into the woven fiber reed baskets they sold their cheese in, The power level would have to come up considerably in order to mark Nitroban. Leela heard the fans in the control box whir to life, and a moment later the scent of burnt brick filled the air. As quickly as the new mill had started, the fans wound down and the cutting head moved back to the stow position. Leela turned and got her first glimpse of the cornerstone of Pax's new house. A place for Pax. Established 2173.
Collateral Damage, written by Jen Downs, read by Emily Hockaday. You gotta help me. We're at Rufio's on the South Concourse. Please, Patsy. There's nobody else we can call. What are you going to do? 5 minutes later, I've locked the doors on the hotel and hung out the "Arcadians will be closed till dinner" sign. In what passes for air, I cut an arc over the shoulder of Olympus. The city's an hour away, due north of the porcupine spines of the colony transmitters. The old truck rattles like a spice grinder. I should get it serviced, but it's a question of cash flow, or the lack thereof. I know it'll hold together today, but it could soon be me making the panic call. You gotta help me. I've gone down west of Chris, and who can afford a tow? Friends always bail you out if you stand by them. What goes around comes right back around. 10 minutes before sundown, the sky takes on its gorgeous blue color. Always reminds me of Earth for a brief while, till the stars shine brighter than they ever do back home. Odd how we still refer to Earth as home, though we haven't seen it in decades and aren't likely to again. With 50 minutes to kill before I see the city lights, I hit callback. Chrissy doesn't answer, which makes me anxious. She's 16 now, that beautiful, dangerous age when the world offers itself up for grabs while older people seem to be bolting every door and window to keep you on the farm. Chrissy Espinosa worries the life out of her two dads. What the hell has she gotten herself into this time? Frustrated, I stab a finger into my contacts list to call my other half, but he's not answering either. Belatedly, I remember he's in Olympia, stocking up the bar and restaurant. Out of options, I leave a rambling message about running up to the port to give Chrissy a ride. Sam shouldn't be concerned, and I'll call again if I'll be late. He'll worry anyway. It's in the Ginelli genes. But at least he knows where I am. I don't like Marsport. I like the South Side, Concourse 4, even less. They installed the glitzy passenger terminals on the North Side, but the South is about warehouses, tanks, 50-meter stacks of containers with handling drums crawling all over them, ants on an anthill. I wish I could say the place stinks, but Martian air is too thin to carry any odor, and since you're canned in a hard suit for the hike in from parking pasture under the rad shield parasols, you couldn't smell it anyway. Smaller freighters dock by four. Crates like Marty Pirelli's Outrigger 144, Irene Kruger's Pignatello, and a bunch that are less savory. Crews you wouldn't want to run into in the dockside alleys around midnight. What's Chrissy doing here? And who's we, she quoted, at Rufio's? The proverbial bad feeling makes my hackles rise as I tromp through the outfield into the eye-shriveling wash of floodlights. Scanners look me over at the triple airlock, pick up the suit transponder, and the lock cycles. Then I'm in, helmet off, blinking in dimness punctuated by work lights and too many signs. Half of them appear to be busted, the rest graffitied. The first face I pick out of the sparse crowd belongs to Chrissy Espinosa, pretty in a sharp-featured way, with the black eye makeup kids prefer these days. Pink blonde hair pulled up on top of her head. The second face, right behind her, belongs to Vijay Mukherjee. He looks downright scared. They're babbling, the moment they see me, 16 and 17 respectively, way out of their depth, and panicked. I puzzle the story together from fragments, and might have laughed if Vij didn't look so terrified and Chrissy didn't sound frantic. It isn't actually funny. She'd only tagged along for the ride with a pal from school when Vij came up from the region we affectionately call the Red Sands to pick up a delivery. The Mukherjee clan runs a homestead east of Arcadia, 20 hectares of strawberries, tomatoes, salad greens. There's no more money in their stead than any other family farm in this colony, and too many people trying to live on it.
Veej is only killing time, waiting for his transfer to college in Olympia. He wants to be an EMT. He'll be a good one, if he survives tonight. I hold up both hands to stop them. Well, let me get this straight. Chris, you came for coffee and giggles when Veej trucked over to collect a new farm bot. He gestures wildly. It all happened when I was parking, on the loading dock. It's a reconditioned GPM-22 shipped up from some mine in the south. They're cheap. We've bought four of them already. This never happened before. One of the reasons these GPM, general purpose mechs, don't cost much is that their tech was on the obsolete list a decade before Veej and Chrissy were born. Older tech is no problem on the farm. But here at the port, their remote command frequency can spell trouble. It's too damn close to the bands used by the big freight scanners. Whoa, let me guess. A barge landed just when the local trash hauler unloaded your bot? A pretty safe bet. He nods miserably. Freight from Luna, which means MCQ has to scan it before they'll unload. Hunting for parasites, contraband, stowaways, uncoded freight, any number of illegal oddments. Mars Customs and Quarantine is notoriously tight, but barges inbound from Earth and Luna are supposed to be scanned at the marshalling yards on Phobos, so our local scanners don't have to be cranked to max. At full power, they interfere with entertainment streaming to the passenger terminals. They can bust up navigation on private vehicles like my truck or VJ's. They'll also override the command frequency on these old bots. Before a mech's tiny brain is reconfigured, it idles one level above the basic core program. Not much more than mindless hardware with enough strength to tear a rad bunker out of the ground. I groan. Your mech took off on its own? He hugs himself dejectedly. Okay, kid. What's the damage? Veej is a good-looking boy, willowy and tall, like Chrissy, since he grew up on Mars. They're both way taller than me. I'm looking up at them, crick in my neck. He can't bring himself to say it. And Chrissy drones. Two vending machines, six tables, three chairs, 40 assorted pieces of crockery, the barista machine, a baggage trolley, and Freight Marshal Pugh's new rucksack. Pugh, as in Frank Pugh? A glimmer of light dawns. I give the kids a hard look. Now, be dead sure. No mistakes. Did you sign anything before the bot took off on its own? Has Pugh made you sign anything at all? He tried, and I nearly did, VJ confesses miserably. But Chrissy said don't, call you instead. You didn't call your parents? I wonder, but I'm not surprised. It's $9,000, Patsy, Chrissy bleats urgently. Marshal Pugh quoted the damages in the report. He wants us to pay. Mr. Mukherjee doesn't have that kind of money. We couldn't call him, and Marshal Pugh said we'd be in court. It's the law. Whoa again. I stopped them with a sharp word. You signed nothing. Two heads shake. Go get a soda. Calm down. Leave this to me. Flickers of real anger replace the amusement as I march to the freight inquiries desk, and there's Frank, much as I remember him. Just a little older, grayer, more worn around the edges. But if I know Frank Pugh, one thing won't have changed. He's the laziest dude I ever met. If there's an easy way to do something, he'll find it. Sticking a couple of teens who don't know any better with a bill for $9,000 would save him 2 hours worth of paperwork and 10 vid calls. He looks up, sees me coming, and blinks in surprise. His mouth compresses into a disapproving line. He won't sucker me the way he almost took the kids, and he knows it. If it ain't Patsy Pulaski, you're a long way from the Arcadians. Don't you have beer to brew or fish to fry? Nice try, Frankie. I've seen him in the hotel many times. I know how he prefers his nachos, and he's fully aware of my business. I thump my helmet onto his counter. Where's the mech? He jerks a thumb over his shoulder. Storeroom. Turned off. Turn it on, get it out, and sign the release. You know the law, same as I do. The kids don't, but at least Chrissy Espinoza has enough brains to call me. Their bot, he spits, bashed its way out of Freight 9, blundered through the diner, and busted everything in front of it. None of which is the responsibility of anyone named Mukherjee. I leaned both elbows on the counter. Veej and Chris were on the loading dock when the fun happened, which means, I add with a malicious glee, at the time, the bot remained the responsibility of the vendor, shipper, and handler. You know that. I know that. He appears to be grinding his teeth. You also know you turned it on with a cargo scanner cranked out to screaming max. I know that. A growled admission. But you couldn't resist trying it with a couple of kids who are green as gourds. If by some fluke they'd paid, this was always going to boomerang right into court for a refund. Allow me to guess. It would have been on someone else's watch. Put a lid on it, Pulaski, he says belligerently, but he's shuffling screens like a deck of cards in the shimmering display. Who's going to sign? 10 minutes later, we're out on the parking pasture, three hard suits plus a slightly battered, reconditioned mech still wearing a faded stencil from Barsoom Venture Mining, your Iron Jeddak. The bot is under control. All VJ has to do is slide a ram stick into the socket on its chest, and he's in business. Tomorrow, it'll be picking strawberries with the finesse of a concert flautist. Thanks, Patsy, Chrissy says for the sixth time. We owe you one. You owe me 10, I tell her. Next time, I'll call you, yeah? I watch them load the bot and take off into the floodlight's blue glare. In 90 minutes, they'll be on the Mukherjee stead with a story to tell. I'll regale Sam over supper, but for the moment, Frank does have a point. I do have a hotel to run, beer to brew, and fish to fry. I slide into the truck, fire the igniters, and trip the sound system for the flight back to my own turf.